all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wiscommon Sense. From up here on the rainy shores of Lake Wissota, where we have thunderstorms rumbling through, but it's still a beautiful day up north. It is a Wednesday, July 26th. It is 71 degrees up here on Lake Wissota. Pretty consistent temperatures around the state as some showers move through. 70 degrees in Waukesha, in Wisconsin Rapids, in Wausau. 71 in Oshkosh, 67 in Amory, where folks are hearing us on Lake Air Radio all across the Civic Media Radio Network. Nice to have you along. Got some nice segments for you coming up this morning, surrounded by some headlines and other chatter. And at 6:30, we'll have our weekly climate check report with Melissa Baldoff. And we'll talk about the hostile climate out there for folks who don't really have a lot of political voice or power. You see, there's a growing push in government to ensure that vulnerable populations, the ones most impacted by a changing climate, can start to have their voices heard when it comes to preventing future damages or addressing current concerns. But naturally, there's one political party that thinks that's a terrible idea and is opposing Governor Tony Evers' efforts to embrace it. We'll also talk about the settlement that's been reached, avoiding a crippling strike against UPS and marking a big win for American workers. In our second hour, we have an author talking about their new book, one that I'm looking forward to reading and hearing more about, all about the day that Hubert flipped the script. This is the 75th anniversary of the 1948 Democratic Convention, when a young Minneapolis mayor named Hubert Humphrey helped his party escape its slide toward irrelevance and find the courage to throw off the dead weight that came from decades of racism. The author, Samuel Friedman's new book, describes how the future vice president went from naive dreamer to modern leader, and will ask how Wisconsin's leaders at the time handled the long march toward embracing civil rights. So Sam Friedman coming up at 7:30 this morning here on Up North News Radio. And along the way, if you've got questions or comments, you can call us at 844-967-2789. It might be that you're watching the video feed and your question is, why are you in glasses today and why do you look half dead? And the reason is one that you might have heard in previous family visits. I know that Aaron's probably heard it and has gotten sick of it. Good morning, Mr. Zommers. But once again, I have been visited by grandchildren who I love dearly. But then I see the runny nose and the sniffles, and next thing I know, a day or so later, I'm feeling absolutely walloped. I love those kids, but my God, they're little petri dishes. They're little vectors what they are.
They always are. It's unavoidable. Oh,
goodness, I feel like I've been living off of ibuprofen for the past 24 hours plus here, just solid. But we will, carry on through the day here. I was already planning to take Friday off as we wrap up our staycation together here. I'm going to tell you tomorrow is 50-50 at this point, but we'll see how things go. But again, if you want to offer chicken noodle soup recipes or anything, you can reach us at 844-967-2789. Down there, showers, thunderstorms reach you guys yet, or are you still quiet?
Well, the ground's wet. If it rained last night, I slept through it.
Well, that's actually what got me up this morning was not my alarm, but just some very loud claps of thunder right around 3:45. And you look at your phone and you go, I could sleep for a few minutes more. And then comes some more thunder and you go, yeah, that's not really happening there, is it? So, nature will do its alarm clock whenever it wants to do it. And there's really not much you can do about it, Civic Pints is the blood drive that's going on I hear, Aaron, that it has been extended, if I heard correctly, that it no longer ends at the end of July, or was I by any chance misinformed?
That sounds right, although I'm not 100% certain.
Yeah, I believe it was, because again, it'll still be summer after next week. And on top of that, there are so many more prizes to give away. I mean, we're talking dozens of Milwaukee Brewers tickets and Wisconsin State Fair tickets and Civic Media swag. And all you've got to do is do your part to help the way that blood banks run low during the summertime as some folks get out of the habit of regular donations like they might do during the school year. So get in, donate blood, take a selfie while you're doing it, and then post it to social media with the hashtag CivicPints, P-I-N-T-S, like a pint of blood. And you could be eligible to have your name plucked out of a, I don't know, do we pluck them out of a hat here or out of one of those bags that they collect blood in? I'm not really sure. But they'll pick your name out and you could win one of these prizes, one of these cool prizes.
Yeah, and we have so many of them. It'd be a shame to end it at the end of the month when we're definitely still going to have more.
Oh, yeah. The need will still very much be out there. So keep that in mind as well. The Up North News Daily Newsletter comes out every weekday morning. And Christina Laurie was on with us yesterday and let us know that, you know, this week marks the 175th anniversary of the University of Wisconsin. And actually, that date is today. It was July 26th, 1848, that Wisconsin's first governor and legislature officially created the UW. And so in our newsletter today, all kinds of historical notes and rankings about the UW system, along with some other of the day's headlines as well, not to mention a father-son duo from Hayward, which is advancing ahead in the latest season of American Idol, and so much more. So go to upnorthnewswi.com and sign up for our newsletter there. Come on back. We'll do a few headlines before we talk to Melissa Baldoff about the concept of an Office of Environmental Justice. So much more still ahead wherever you are across Wisconsin on this rainy, stormy morning. You're up north. Thought I might have lost you there for a minute, Aaron, as we came back from break. Or it was just I was putting all these 80 birthday candles into the cake for one Michael Philip Jagger. Mick Jagger turns 80 years old today. A little undercover of the night for you there. The Brewers trailed 4-0 last night before nearly coming all the way back against the Cincinnati Reds. The key point there is nearly. The Reds outlasted a bottom of the ninth Brewers rally that included a three-run homer with two outs from Christian Yelich, as the Reds beat the Brewers 4-3 and reduced Milwaukee's Central Division lead to a half game. Even after the home run, the Brewers had the tying run on second, the potential winning run on first, before the Reds got the final out. Milwaukee had runners on first and third with one out in the second inning, but failed to score when Andrew Monasterio got thrown out, attempting to score all the way from first on a Victor Caratini two-out double to right. And I don't even mean that he was thrown out at the plate. I mean, he was just a dead duck. The ball had come all the way in from right field to the Reds catcher, and Monasterio still wasn't even in the frame at that point, which has me questioning the third base coach, but that's what fans get to do, is question these things. The Brewers and Reds meet one more time this afternoon at American Family Field, and then that'll wrap up the season series. But I mean, they really packed it all into the core of the season. This is the 13th matchup between the two teams since the start of June. And if you go back to May 25th, the Reds have been one of baseball's hottest teams. They have gone 32-9 against all other teams except the Brewers. But again, since late May, the Reds have gone 3-9 against the Brewers, which is why the Brewers still have a half-game lead on this otherwise red-hot Cincinnati team. Freddie Peralta will get the start today. The Brewers are off tomorrow. They will travel to Atlanta to take on the Braves for the weekend, then Washington, D.C. to take on the Nationals for another series before they are back home next week Thursday for a division series against the Pittsburgh Pirates. And you can hear the Brewers in the Fox Valley on Oshkosh Air Support, 98.3 FM, 1100 AM, and News from the Center and Richland Center, 107.7 FM, 1450 AM. All right, off to some headlines. As always, you can react to them. You can vent a little about them. You can share what else is on your mind with a statewide radio audience. by calling 844-967-2789, or you can comment on the video feed that you could find on the Up North News Facebook page, the Civic Media Facebook page. We're also on the Facebook pages of Bull Falls Radio out of Wausau and 93.5 The Tap FM out of Chippewa Falls. We'd love to see your comments. Get your questions as well. And one of the first things that we should mention is that there will not be a potentially crippling strike against the national economy by Teamsters with the United Parcel Service. The Teamsters and UPS reached an agreement to hold end the threat of a walkout by more than 325,000 union members. The union reported in June that its UPS members had voted to authorize a walkout when the current agreement expires next week, August 1st, with a 97% yes vote for striking. This would have hurt. UPS handles about one quarter of the tens of millions of packages that are shipped daily in the United States. It really would have put a dent in economic activity, especially in the e-commerce industry, writes the New York Times in reviewing the agreement. Representatives from more than 150 Teamster locals will meet on Monday to review the agreement. They will vote between August 3rd and August 22nd. But right now, all indications are that the Teamsters and members are happy about it. Teamsters President Sean O'Brien said in a statement, "We demanded the best contract in the history of UPS, and we got it." I'm going to kill my mic for just a second here and take a little sip of coffee and give a little cough. See, again, grandkids, Aaron. Maybe the hazmat suit next time before this happens. But
I'm sure you could find one on eBay.
And now it will be delivered thanks to not having this UPS strike. So what are some of the deals here? Well, the Teamsters said under the tentative agreement, current full and part-time UPS employees represented by the union would get an hourly raise of $2.75 and then $7.50 an hour in raises throughout the course of the contract. The minimum pay for part-timers will rise to $21 an hour, far above the current minimum starting pay of $16.20 an hour, and the top rate for full-time delivery drivers will rise to $49 an hour. Full-time drivers currently make $42 an hour on average after 4 years. The company has pledged to create 7,500 new full-time union jobs and to fill 22,000 open positions for which part-time workers will be eligible. This came about, all of these particulars, because the company had talked about creating a new class of worker. UPS had said it was an arrangement that would allow workers to take on dual roles like sorting packages some days and driving on other days, especially Saturdays. But the Teamsters said the hybrid idea was never actually carried out, and that in practice, the new category of workers drove full-time Tuesday through Saturday only for less pay than the other drivers. What you should read into that, well, first off, is all about the merits of union representation, because otherwise the company was going to jam these new duties, you know, down workers' throats, and they were not going to have any voice. They were not going to be able to do anything about it. It happens in far too many workplaces where, again, it's death by a thousand paper cuts. Well, you can take on this extra role. Oh, you did that. Well, you can take on this extra role. Oh, you did that. I know it was tough, but here, you're going to take on this extra role and continue to push people to the breaking point for little to no extra pay if those workers don't have some kind of seat at the bargaining table, some kind of representation, some kind of leverage. And so, again, while there are many people who say, you know, we don't need labor unions, you're benefiting because of this deal. This deal and everything else that workers have won throughout the years through negotiations benefits everybody in time. I mean, that's the real trickle-down economics, is the fact that, you know, we have things like the 40-hour work week, or weekends, or paid holidays, or children not working in coal mines. You know, these are the things that we all benefit from when you level the playing field a bit because the people who are doing the work for you are being treated more fairly and not being treated like chattel, but being treated like, you know, an asset rather than a liability. So these are the kinds of things that we should be celebrating in the UPS, agreement, and the fact that there's not going to be a strike, but instead, you know, a new generation of workers who are getting adequately paid and not being, treated with this, you know, quote unquote hybrid role, which was just another way to, you know, get more while paying the same. Another article that caught my eye was, this one's also coincidentally in the New York Times. It's the newest essay from Thomas Edsel, who does occasional columns on politics and demographics. And this one, he goes off in several different directions about the differences between Democrats and Republicans or conservatives and progressives. But there's one topic that I find rather fascinating, and that's the subject of this particular column. And that is Americans' views on masculinity and what that translates to in terms of your politics. And Tom Edsel looks at two books published last year, very different in tone, as he puts it. You've got Richard Reeves, who wrote Of Boys and Men. And then you've got manly man, Senator Josh Hawley, whose book was called Manhood, The Masculine Virtues America Needs. And of course, Josh Hawley comes at this from a decidedly right-wing point of view, which is full of bluster, but nothing that really supports it. No menace to this nation is greater than the collapse of American manhood, he declares, placing full blame on the American left. And in fact, they have helped drive it. In power centers they control, places like the press, the academy, and politics, they blame masculinity for America's woes. And on and on he goes. Again, the guy who ran scared out of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Reeves, meanwhile, paints a downbeat picture of the state of men, but contends the solutions lie in an expansion of the progressive agenda, noting that men account for 2 out of 3 deaths of despair, either from a suicide or an overdose. Boys and men of color and those from poorer families are suffering most, in part because of a huge gender gap in education. There's a big gap in what might be called personal agency, he writes, that men are now only about half as likely as women to study abroad or sign up for the Peace Corps or buy their own home as a single adult. And it turns out that if you translate this into voting records, again, you can really see the divide. An associate editor from Politico magazine wrote an article about a poll that asks, do you agree or disagree with the statement, the Democratic Party is hostile to masculine values? Republicans agree, 68-8. Democrats disagree, 62-6. Another one of the core differences is based on how you answer whether you agree or disagree with this statement. Traditional family structure with a wage-earning father and a homemaking mother best equips children to succeed. Republicans agree with that statement, 52% to 24%. Democrats disagree, 59% to 16%. So you've got the Republicans' point of view of, hey, gals, you know, stay home, raise the babies. If you want your family to be a success, that's the way you got to go. That is still a mentality that, for everything that women have gone through over the decades, is still, you know, very much a barrier to their acceptance in the workplace and their success in things like the wage gap. And so there continue to be more comparisons throughout this article, but again, there are some positive touchstones about Gen Z, and that Gen Z voters continue to enter the voting ranks while baby boomers continue to retire and pass away with their conservative values. And while there's no guarantee that that's something that will last into the decades, we do see more and more people in their 20s and 30s whose point of view on what men and women can do, should do, are capable of doing, are much more in line with what really makes for a successful country and economy, as to one that just leads to people shaking their fists saying, get off my lawn and stay home and have babies. We'll have our climate check report with Melissa Baldoff next. You're up north. It's electric. We're back now, and we're going to talk about the climate, our regular climate check feature here with Melissa Baldoff. And in doing so, well, Melissa and I, you know, like to think of ourselves as little capital insiders. And one of the sayings is, you know, if you're arguing process, you're losing. And that's what Republicans appear to be doing here, is arguing about the process of the way that Governor Tony Evers is trying to handle a changing climate, and especially making sure that certain vulnerable populations are no longer silent when it comes to a changing climate and, you know, the damage that it does and the way we can mitigate further harms. Melissa, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very good, thanks. Now, at Up North News, we've done several stories about this back when Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes had his task force on climate change. There was something, one of the recommendations was about creating offices and positions that are related to something called environmental justice, and maybe creating an office of environmental justice, something that the Evers administration is interested in doing, something the Biden administration is interested in doing. So, Melissa, can we talk for a couple of minutes about what is the concept of environmental justice, and why would you have that kind of an office, that kind of position, that kind of a focus in your administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's most important is to just recognize that the climate crisis hits different communities in different ways. And, you know, the ways that our rural communities are impacted, low-income communities, urban areas, and other communities around the state, you know, are feeling that impact kind of first and worst. And having an Office of Environmental Justice, recognizing that environmental justice is important, is just saying, hey, we want to make sure that as we work towards a transition into, you know, a more sustainable approach, that we are recognizing that some of these communities are hit hardest, hit first, hit worst, and want to make sure that's a just transition that acknowledges that different communities need different things at times and is able to support people. So, you know, this really shouldn't be like so many other things. You know, this shouldn't be a fight. This shouldn't be a, you know, an issue. But, you know, I think they want the Republicans, some of them want to gin up controversy here where there really shouldn't be any. You know, this is an effort to ultimately help the people of our state as we address climate change, which is real. And that's, I think, part of the problem is that you've got people in the legislature who don't believe that climate change is real. And that's a problem. And it's out of line with reality, for one. It's also out of line with what the overwhelming majority of Wisconsinites know to be true, is that climate change is real, and it's concerning.
Right. And it shouldn't be contentious, but it's going to be contentious anytime that you've got one group of people who is essentially looking out for the elites. You know, maybe you give them a tax cut that's overwhelmingly large compared to everybody else. But not to get too far off topic here, it also means that you're not looking out for the people who are first and most affected by things like a changing climate. And one of the first examples we used at Up North News was about the Bad River Band of Chippewa, and how at one point decades ago, they were forced to relocate their entire community of Odanah because of the, you know, increasing impacts of flooding on the Bad River, and that other vulnerable populations are the ones who are closest to the coastlines that are being eroded. And I don't just mean the ocean. I mean, like, the, you know, the Great Lakes, and I mean our rivers and things like that. You have, you know, the stronger storms, the wild fluctuations in temperature, the, you know, the sustenance farmers are the ones who are going to see the lower crop yields. We're all going to see more algae blooms.
And it's those areas that an Office of Environmental Justice at least just says, hey, you know, can we consider this and not just, you know, what the McMansions are going to be going through? At least that's my interpretation of what I'm seeing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and you think of the fact you talk to folks, especially in, you know, areas in Southwest Wisconsin who have been dealing with, you know, 500 year floods every 2 or 3 years. So, you know, this is having an Office of Environmental Justice just says, hey, we recognize that different communities are hit differently, and we want to ensure everyone's got what they need to be safe, to, you know, be able to operate their businesses, keep their communities safe.
Yeah. And it really, I see a two-pronged approach here. At the state level, the concept says that if state local governments are making decisions that affect the environment, then make sure you include the voices of those who are heavily impacted but frequently overlooked. But then at the federal level, I should say, you have the Biden administration setting up an Office of Environmental Justice inside the U.S. Department of Justice. And what they're saying is that when there are cases of environmental harm, that office puts a priority on prosecuting the cases that are impacting the communities most affected. And again, it's simply one way of making sure that government, you know, looks out for everybody, not just the people with the most money or the loudest voices.
Exactly. That's exactly right. You know, we see it not just in Wisconsin, but we see it all over the place. You know, you think about how unhealthy, unsafe the drinking water had to be in Flint for something to happen. And we see in communities around Wisconsin that there are incredibly high levels of lead in the water. And often that is an occurrence in the communities that are least equipped financially to address the issues. And like you said, it shouldn't just be that the wealthiest people, the wealthiest businesses, the wealthiest communities are able to mitigate the harm of pollution and climate change. Every community, every business, every family should have an equal opportunity to have a safe and healthy life.
And if you think that right now, Republicans running the Wisconsin legislature are in fact looking out for equal opportunities for people when it comes to environmental hazards, just keep in mind the multiple times that Republicans have said, when asked, why aren't you helping more fully fund lead pipe replacement in Milwaukee or lead pipe replacement overall, their response has been along the lines of, well, too much of that money goes to Milwaukee, to which I would respond, well,
exactly.
Yeah, that's where the problem is.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. They're, you know, it just seems that they're so worried that there could be a benefit to Milwaukee that they're willing to let the rest of the state be harmed too,
which just doesn't make sense. And if they want to make some inroads, figure out why aren't we getting more support? Well, maybe try leading the way on, you know, addressing something that is literally, you know, life altering, but, you know, they can't do that. So instead we get back to talking about the process and whether Governor Evers, in creating an Office of Environmental Justice and in looking for funding for it, because again, not everything comes through the legislature. Sometimes there are other private funds, there are federal funds and things like that. You know, is Evers doing everything without having to say, Mother, may I, every time the legislature wants to second guess what he's doing? At least that's the gist of what I got from a recent story in the Milwaukee newspaper, is that, you know, again, Republicans felt like if they can't micromanage the governor, then there must be something wrong.
Right. And, you know, you also are seeing, you know, they're kind of, you know, moaning and groaning that there could be, like you said, potentially funds coming in from outside sources. And if they have a problem with that, they could have done what the governor proposed in the budget and funded the office and then had some oversight, some input in the, you know, the funding streams that would be in that office. But they, you know, they didn't want to have the office. They didn't want to make it a priority. And now that the governor is using his authority that he has executive authority to still create this office, you know, they want to, you know, they want to moan and groan about it and complain. And I think that's just kind of more what we expect is from them, is that, you know, they have opportunities to be part of a solution, and instead they just want to, you know, bellyache about it and do nothing. So, you know, that it's unfortunate, because that would have been, you know, one of many great opportunities to demonstrate collaboration, a willingness to work together, be bipartisan, because, you know, the climate crisis is not a partisan issue. It is impacting everybody. And Republicans really could be part of the solution, but instead they just want to, you know, they want to complain about the solutions the governor is coming up with, you know,
well,
absent their support.
And unfortunately, what happens too often is as we've seen them do with Governor Evers and with Attorney General Josh Call, is to look for ways to officially curtail the kinds of things that the executive branch can do. You see it at the federal level with the ongoing efforts to try to restrict things like the Environmental Protection Agency. And yet, see, these are some of the same people that, I mean, my first thought, snarky as it is that, well, if only Governor Evers had done this through, you know, Jared and Ivanka, I guess that would be fine then, because that seems to be how it often happens, is that, you know, Rudy Giuliani goes to handle it, or Paul Manafort goes to handle it. Governor Evers is trying to do it through the rule book, which also means that it takes longer and you open yourself up to criticism, but at least it has more transparency than it does when you just get a buddy to do these things instead. You know, that's my two cents anyway.
Exactly. Yep. I think that's right.
So that's where we'll look from here. And that's, so in this week's climate check, we wanted to give an update on what one governor's been trying to do about, you know, the climate and mitigating its impacts on vulnerable populations. And, you know, you've got a legislature that could either help in that effort, or they could argue process, which is, again, you know, why they're losing on matters about climate and matters about, you know, a governor who still, again, they'd like to point at his high disapproval numbers, but he's still got these approval numbers they could only wish for. Melissa Baldoff, thanks for taking a few minutes and helping us explain what this week's issue is. Take care. We'll talk again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks.
All right, let's do a little follow-up on a previous discussion from just yesterday when we talked to Hans Breitenmoser and Sarah Lloyd, and we talked about anti-competitive practices that are impacting Wisconsin farmers. And in a note from a Wisconsin Public Radio article, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is going to join a group of other state attorneys general to work with federal officials on such anti-competitive practices in agriculture. There will be at least 31 AGs that are taking part in some of these practices that aren't just hurting farmers, but, you know, Wisconsin-based food processors and suppliers. They'll be looking for instances of price gouging and other retail practices. And it's going to start with a rather broad focus so that it makes it easier to identify, you know, specific practices. It's something that has come up in past Democratic administrations. I know early on the Obama administration was asked to look into anti-competitive practices in big dairy, especially in cheese making. Certainly there's going to be that impact in other states. The National Farmers Union did a campaign starting a couple of years back, asking both state and federal officials to just enforce the existing antitrust laws and try to bring back a sense of balance to market power between the people who are farming and, you know, the large corporations. We really saw this in the pandemic when any given meatpacking plant suddenly had all kinds of workers catching COVID and many of them dying. And it was only then that I think a lot of us really became aware that, I think it's something like, you know, four huge companies control so much of the meat supply. And when you have very few, but very large processing operations, not only is that bad for the food supply, but that can certainly lead to, you know, anti-competitive practices and higher prices than you otherwise would if you encouraged a whole lot of, you know, non-ginormous state-based entities. And so that and other things will be looked at over the course of the next, I don't know if it could be months, could be years.
And while nothing's going to happen quickly on it, the fact that conversations like the ones we had here on the radio yesterday and like state attorneys generals are having right now tells us that at least there is the possibility for some progress in getting farmers and local producers some better prices just through bringing competition back to the free enterprise system. All right, we're slated to have Melissa Kay from locally grown radio, WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids, coming up. There she is chiming in right now. So we'll have today's history lesson and music break coming up in just a bit. You're up north. And it is Mick Jagger's birthday today. Raise your hand if you're surprised that Mick Jagger made it to his 80th birthday. I see all out there, but there he goes. Mick Jagger turns 80 years old today from the Rolling Stones. Other birthdays. Where are my manners? There's a guest here, Melissa Kay from locally grown radio, WFHR. Good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
And you're doing some double duty this week, you said?
Yes. One of my colleagues is on vacation, so I'm covering news for multiple markets this week.
All right. Well, appreciate you taking a little bit of time just to play with us and do some guessing on music and birthdays and things like that.
Absolutely.
We're going to hear from Dobie Gray a little later on. His big song was Drift Away. He turns 83 today. Darlene Love, 82. And actress Sandra Bullock. You know how old she is today?
Want to take a guess? I would guess she's probably like 47.
Oh, she would love you for that. 59. She and I are just a couple of weeks apart.
Wow.
And I can't really hold a candle to her and how well you age at the age of 59. So good on her. Mm-hmm. If I said, again, I don't know why I do all these things to prove how old I am. But if I mentioned the power couple of music in the 70s, Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., would you know the group where they met and did most of their work?
Nope.
I was afraid of that. All right. Well, those would be the two lead singers of the Fifth Dimension. And they got married this day in 1969. The Fifth Dimension went on to have many hits, but then the duo did their own, had their own hit in 1977. And of course, this is one of those, I picked a song with something like a 30-second intro, so now I've got to go on and tell you more about the Fifth Dimension, and I could have played, you know, Up, Up, and Away, and all those other things where you ever feel like you're the last person that still listens to a particular album or a group or anything like that? That's definitely me with the Fifth Dimension. I have a few songs of theirs on my phone. You got anything like that at all where you go, oh, nobody else has this but me?
Well, I have an odd eclectic music taste, so maybe.
Okay. Nope, that totally works. There's our bit of the Fifth Dimension there. I was looking to see if
it's
I
very
had...
70s.
It's extremely 70s, you know, and again, that's mid 70s as the Fifth Dimension. Marilyn McCoo did Last Night I Didn't Get to Sleep at All. There was One Less Bell to Answer, Aquarius, Let the Sun Shine In, and of course, Up, Up, and Away. So anyway, Marilyn McCoo, Billy Davis Jr. Let's see, this would make it 54 years of a marriage for them. Okay.
Aww, congratulations.
On this day in 1951, Walt Disney's 13th animated film, Alice in Wonderland, premiered in London. Gotta say, not a big Alice in Wonderland person. I'm pretty straightforward. I don't go for like the Fantasia and the, you know, the things that go off in all kinds of weird directions. Clearly other people do. I mean, there's a niche for that. Just not mine.
I directed an Alice in Wonderland ballet multiple years ago.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was fun.
Okay. All right.
I know my sisters were in an Alice in Wonderland play. And the thing I remember most about it is that one of the funniest, like, local high schooler actors when I was in probably like fifth or sixth grade played the doorknob. And it was so funny to have him face painted with a big doorknob on his nose, just sticking his head through. Oh, what are you doing? Like honking on my nose and all that stuff.
Cute.
Let's see. We've got another prototypical 70s song coming up here. The number one song this day in 1975. One hit wonder Van McCoy had this one. So last night I'm putting this together, and I've got my 16, soon to be 17 year old grandson, and a friend of his who came out as well from Idaho. And I started, you know, mentioning some of these bits of history and asked if they knew any of them. And I started the intro of The Hustle, and I said, "You guys familiar with this at all?" Nope, hadn't heard anything. But then the part that you just heard as they hit the chorus of Do the Hustle, they're like, "Oh, yeah, totally know that." And they named some show or movie that it's from, and the 9-year-old also is singing some kind of song that I thought, how do you know this? But again, TV shows and cartoons, you know, they'll grab some old tunes and put them in and give music a new sense of life.
Mm-hmm.
On this day in 1971, Apollo 15 launched. Oh, this is the one I was telling the boys about yesterday. We thought Apollo 15 was so cool because it was the first use of the lunar rover. There was a car on the moon.
Driving on the moon.
Oh, I mean, this was just America had arrived. We're putting cars everywhere now. Thankfully, we don't do that quite so much with cars everywhere. But
it's,
you know,
probably not gas powered, is it?
Oh no, no solar.
There we go.
Yeah, you're not going to find E85, you know, pumps anywhere there in the Sea of Tranquility. Now, this is one I thought was good to note, that this is the anniversary of the birth of George Clinton. He was an American general and a politician, and he was born in 1739. He was the fourth vice president of the United States and one of two vice presidents who actually served as vice president for two consecutive presidents. George Clinton served under Thomas Jefferson and then James Madison. And I only bring it up because so many people see things named after Clinton, like Clintonville, you know, in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of Clintons, but I'm sure younger folks go, you know, is that Bill Clinton? Like, no. There was George Clinton. He was a big deal way, way back. So when you see a Clinton, think of George Clinton. Mm-hmm. The number one song this day in 1986 was by Peter Gabriel. You guys ever see the video for Sledgehammer, which probably is just a regular thing now, but it was one of those big deals then. The, you know, digital animation was really starting to take off, and Peter Gabriel transformed himself into all kinds of objects and things like that. Once again, Grandpa's just waxing poetic about the early days of technology.
What's a music video?
Yeah, okay, all right, moving on. One more. On this day in 2011, Eric Church released his breakthrough album, Chief, which included the hits Springsteen and this one, Drink in My Hand. All right, Melissa, you are so busy doing double duty, but what can you tell us about what's happening at locally grown radio these days?
Well, I do know that we are going to do an interview with the Wood County Board Chairman, Lance Plimmel, today on our morning magazine segment, which moved to the afternoons. And I know tomorrow we have Hoozles Rise to Music happening in Rome, Wisconsin at Hoozles at the Lake. It's our second annual competition with this, and it's bringing local musicians and helping them rise up through the music industry. It'll be six local musicians competing for that number one spot.
Very cool. Melissa, thank you so much. And thanks for doing a little triple duty with us today, along with all your other goings on. Have a wonderful day.
My pleasure. You too.
All right. When we come back, we are going to be talking in our next hour with author Samuel Friedman and his new book about how Hubert Humphrey helped Democrats avoid the slide toward irrelevance and actually embrace civil rights and the future. That's up next. You're Up North.